Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Marilyn Okoro. We talk all about her journey to becoming an Olympic athlete and the impact that trying to fit in had on her eating disorder behaviours and also the way that she saw her body. We then speak about how she has now retired and how she is adapting in life to be more kind to herself and to honour the person that she is.
It's so lovely to have you on the podcast. Like you say, I feel like this... it's years, literally years in the making. So it's so nice to finally sit down and chat to you. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me, Hannah. Oh my gosh, no, like literally I feel full of beans now. I was full of colds, now I'm full of beans.
Excellent, that is so good. So for the listeners, do you want to give an intro about yourself and the things that you get up to?
So I can give a cheesy intro now.
Yes, absolutely. I will hand the baton over to you.
I like that. Absolutely.
Thank you.
My name's Marilyn Okoro. I'm known as Maz, and I am a retired athlete, I can confidently say, but once an Olympian, always an Olympian. So I proudly represented Team GB for, 16 years. I've been a runner for 20 plus years, and I've travelled the globe. It is a very unique career, but running literally just gave me so much opportunity. Currently, I have transitioned into corporate space and I work in talent acquisition, which is a fancy name for recruiting excellent talent into a data infrastructure company called Equinix. And I'm the program manager, so I bring in new to career talent as well as interns into the company. So I get to wear my coaching and mentoring hat. I'm also a public speaker and an avid, passionate campaigner for all things, you know, raising awareness for, you know, I feel like I found my voice when I retired, and I really want to use that to advocate for those who don't feel seen or heard or like they belong. So thank you for having me, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Amazing. And I'm so inspired by the work that you do, because I think I've had quite a few athletes on the podcast. I don't think I've ever had an Olympian though, so that is very exciting. And if I have, that's now going to be really offensive to them because I can't remember. But I think one thing that's, you know, definitely a challenge is the kind of mentality that you have to have when you're an athlete. And it is, you know, it's all encompassing. It takes over your whole entire life. And I guess you do have to make sacrifices that to random Joe Blogs on the street, they might think, that seems a lot. But I can imagine those sacrifices that you have to make do really impact on your mental health. And that kind of rise and strive to get to the top must be really challenging to navigate.
Yeah. Yes. We, as athletes, we love to have this conversational debate about sacrifice versus choice. And I think in the beginning, it's painted as these choices and, you know, but actually down the line, depending on how you've nurtured and stewarded and been supported in making those choices, it does become sacrifice. And sometimes you look back, and as I did when I retired after 20 years, thinking I was living the dream, and actually I was like, I've woken up to a nightmare, and what have I spent 20 years doing? Unfortunately, my mental health had taken a huge dip, and the thing that was keeping me going all these years was now pulled from under me. So I was no longer running. There was a whole load of, I guess, chemical things going on, and, you know, physical things going or not going on, but emotionally I was grieving. I didn't actually have any energy to run, so it wasn't a case, and lots of people kept saying, just go for a run, you feel better, and it was the last thing I wanted to do because it was attached to a lot of trauma. And so the mindset, I love that you touch on that so straight away. That's kind of, I call myself a champion you coach, because it's all about champion mindset. And whether you're an athlete or not, you've got champion mindset, because it's when you've got a dream or a goal, you're willing to do whatever it takes. And I think that's what drives us athletes. We are just willing to do whatever it takes to achieve that vision that we have. And yeah, you need a good support network around you, because you can just keep on going as I did. And I didn't realize how focused I was until I stopped. And it's not always the healthiest of focuses.
Yeah, and I absolutely want to come on to talk about your retirement in a second and the shift and how you navigated that, because I think that like you said, your basically one coping mechanism was ripped out from under you. So how the hell do you cope with that? But I wanted to, I guess, start by talking about your journey as an athlete. And I think, like you kind of touched on there, to be an athlete, you have to have a particular mindset. It has to be that sort of, I am willing to sacrifice whatever to get to the top, which is in an essence is a fantastic mindset to have, because you are going to succeed. You know, you have to have that dedication to achieve. But like anything, there's a flip side to that as well. And things can then get a bit uncomfortable or difficult because it's that kind of all or nothing mindset, I guess. So do you want to tell us a little bit about your journey whilst you were running in terms of, I guess, things that you had to sacrifice?
Yeah, so let's start at the beginning, a little journey down memory lane.
We love a journey.
Life is all about the journey. I grew up in Northwest London, so everyone knows Wembley. Wembley. I grew up tucked behind there. The state called Stonebridge Estate is notorious for the gang culture, high crime rates, low income community. There's a lot of talent there. I've learned there's a lot of talent. I always say I'm built by Brent, that's the borough I'm very proud to come from. And hardship was the norm. I'm from a single parent home. My mum did the best she could with what she had at the time, but she was quite absent from the home a lot. So as the eldest daughter or child in a home, especially of Nigerian background, you are a second parent. And I grew up very quickly and I became very over responsible. So my story sounds like a fairy tale in the beginning, because at 10 years old, you know, I'd been in care, I'd had a lot of difficult things to navigate and a lot of trauma. But at 10 years old, I got to go to this boarding school, and it was like I was just plucked out of Stonebridge and plonked into this beautiful surroundings in Hemel Hempstead, countryside. And I say school was the playground of opportunities, and it really was. I got to be a child. I got to, you know, some of my best friends to this day are from Abbots Hill Girls' School. And you were nurtured and you were taught to dream big and, you know, given the tools to just try things and explore. And that's something I really want to impress on young people today, like just give it a go. And that's where I discovered running. I can't say it was a love at first sight, because I actually loved a game called lacrosse. It's called the boundaryless game, and it's you have a stick and you run everywhere. It's quite aggressive, but
that is, no offense, but that's definitely a classic private girls' school sport. Like,
that and hockey, and we weren't big enough to get both. So I'm glad it went for lacrosse, because, you know, my legs, I'm going to protect my legs. and here's the thing, you know, I'm not a classic private school girl. I'm coming from the council estate, and I've got a funny story about that, because I remember year seven, one of my friends, Kate McCarthy, I'm going to call her out, she said, you know, where do you live? And I was at a stage where I was like, let me not be ashamed of where I'm from, let's be honest. And I said, I live on Stonebridge Estate. And she was like, how many acres is that? And I was like, no, you mean blocks.
Oh, no.
But it was fabulous. So anyway, my PE teacher told me one day to go to running club, and I thought, why? I'm fast enough. I'm running all over the pitch, can't you see? But as proper, you know, good boarding school girls, we did as we're told. And I went to running club on a Friday night in the mud and the rain. And I was like, why am I here? But I'm really glad I'm there. I met, you know, one of my destiny changers, I call him my destiny helpers. And that was my first coach, George Harrison, not the Beatle, but he's amazing. Like, just this man was my second dad. He saw the talent I had. He's the one that planted the Olympic seed and dream. I didn't really take it seriously because no one around me had gone to the Olympics. So, okay, whatever. But he really taught me some key lessons. And that was like, you've got a dream, chase it. And, you know, hard work will outdo talent that doesn't want to work hard. So we just kept going. And like, there was no fancy trills. We just worked hard. I turned up to running club in the summer. I went to the track, and that's when I really feel like I fell in love. I'm a fair weather athlete. There was no mud. I could just run fast. And I just plundered away. As a junior athlete, I think, you know, obviously at school level, I was a big fish in a small pond. Then when I went on to like the national stage, I was like, oh, you know, and I just carried on and carried on. I went on to another boarding school, and I was the only girl that was really interested in running. So I ran with the boys, and I was just like, it's cool because I can beat the boys as well. That seed he planted about the Olympics kind of stayed with me, but my mum was like, I didn't send you to school to run, read your book. She wanted me to be a lawyer or a doctor. So she was my first no, and I was definitely fueled by no's, a lot of no's in the beginning. And then when I got to Bath Uni, you know, what an arena for sport. Like, you had all the creme de la creme of all sports there. So I started to get closer to this, you know, Olympic realization. And I think as well, I started to make impressions on the national scene. And as a junior athlete, so I was starting to come third and second and, you know, run good times that were, you know, pricking the governing body's ears. But no one thought I was going to be a great 800 runner. And in my final year of uni, I went and made the Commonwealth Games team and ran a really quick time of 2:01. And they were like, who is she? We thought she was, who is she? But hey, I was going to Australia. Slight issue with my final year, but University of Bath recognised talent, let me split my dissertation and extend it to the next year. And that's where I realised, you know, from 10 to 21, I was like, okay, I'm actually going to do this because the Olympics is now away. This is 2006. Went to the Commonwealth Games, ran the golden 2 minutes. And I think that's where I started to take it seriously myself. And voila, that was the beginning, which took me into, thrusted me into the elite world, which I think, like I said, it's very much a fairy tale from, you know, car parks running around the concrete, you know, Brent to stadiums, Olympic stadiums in 2008, lining up with my, you know, people that I just looked up to, Maria Mottola, some of the best girls in the world. And it all happened very quickly. And I think when it happens very quickly, you often don't know what you did to get there. I know it was kind of persistence and perseverance and a lot of grit. But the elite world, I don't think I was ready for. And as many highs as there are some tumultuous lows. And that's the bit I wished I was a bit more prepared for, which fuels a lot of the work that I do now. I'm passionate about athlete welfare, passionate about, you know, being on the board of UKA. I'm there to be the athlete voice and advocate and give a lens that is often dismissed. You know, I think it's interesting. You can't have a sports championship without the athletes. So often we're the last to be considered. Why is that? So love to kind of demystify things and shake things up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, wow, what a journey. That just sounds, I don't know whether you've seen it on BBC, but there's a programme called Borders.
Oh, no, I'm going to take note of that, no.
But it literally sounds like your story. So they take five black students from an estate and they then take them to like a fancy boarding school in the country. And there's loads of like, they get loads of kind of racial abuse and things like that, but they really fight back to, and you know, it's really uncomfortable to watch, but I think it has such a brilliant message in that, you know, just because you're from an estate or, you know, based on your colour or whatever, does not define like the sort of schooling that you should have and things like that. So very good programme.
Interesting, you know, obviously tackling the whole social mobility thing. And just last week, I was at the Rugby Blacklist, which was so incredible. It's like a football blacklist. They created it, and it's to celebrate black excellence in rugby. And obviously, rugby's quite a well-to-do sport. I encountered it at boarding school. But it was so good to see so many other black, you know, individuals who'd gone to boarding school. I had an amazing experience. I have to say, abuse was not something I encountered until much later in my sporting career. But at Abbots Hill, I was the only black girl in the many rooms. And even going on to, you know, Stowe, which was really prestigious, you know, that's alumni like Richard Branson and Mick Jagger's son, James Jagger, and Henry Cavill. But I think because of my running and also my generation, we just assimilated. We just wanted to fit in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, often when I went back to Stonebridge, they're like, why do you talk like that? And I was like, I don't know any other way to speak. I was in the debating club and this is how I speak. And so I'm going to check out Borders because I had a very different experience and I know things are very different now, but yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was just really like interesting to kind of watch it and be like, this sort of thing still happens and clearly that we still need a lot of change. So when you kind of went into the elite world, you said that you weren't really ready for what that brought. What was the sort of main differences between what you were doing before and then when you were thrusted into the elite world?
Oh, what a great question. I think the main difference is my coach really cared about Marilyn, the young girl that he met at 10 years old, and was doing everything in my best interest. When you become an elite athlete, you are, you know, you're supported financially, and there's a lot of different stakeholders that want a piece of you and think that you owe them a piece of you. And you're often, I've had to reframe this because I was my brand. We talk about this a lot now, branding yourself, and you're the CEO of your table. But back then it was, I felt so indebted to everyone that gave me any little opportunity. And although, you know, my talent was what got me there and nurtured by the environment, I think my environment a lot was quite a tough environment. So that, you know, either fight or flight, and I chose to fight, and that made me tough. But I think when you get into the elite world, it is very cutthroat and it's a business, and I didn't have that business mindset. I feel a bit thrown to the wolves. And one thing that was, they say don't have regrets, but it's okay to have regrets. We have regrets, and it's something that I would change for someone else if I'm advising them. My separation from my first coach wasn't handled well. And when you know better, you can do better. But I think that there's often a time, and I see it a lot with my mentees when they go to America on scholarship and the coach at home isn't happy and then doesn't want to sort of collaborate, but they need you to keep that continuity going. And I didn't have that. You know, I was going through a mega transition. I'm passionate about transitions because we go through them all the time. Going from a university student to a world-class athlete, mega transition, mega jump. And I needed all parties involved to work together. I needed my first coach. I need my university coach. I need my pro coach. I need my agent. They need to all collaborate, but they were all competing against each other. And the collateral damage is me. I just kept running, and I was making these huge leaps and bounds, and it was Olympics, and it's all euphoric, but eventually it catches up with you. So, you know, there's a lot of things that athletes aren't aware of. You just see the glitz and the glamour on TV, and, you know, there's so much going on beneath the surface. There's so much. Financial literacy is a big one. You know, you're not making a stable income, an athlete. There's a lot of money to be made. It is tough, but you also need to know how to steward it well. And as easily as you can make money, you can lose it. The mental toll of what you're doing is just, I can't describe it. I suffered such burnout that now in my corporate job, I'm almost allergic. Like when I see it coming, I'm like, it also fuels me to dip out. I think you can see the same toxic kind of push at all costs in corporate because it's chasing success and high performance. But I also I'm very highly aware of this is my limit and what my non-negotiables are. So yeah, there's a lot that we can prepare elite athletes before they get into that arena to be aware of. Just, you know, knowledge is power. And when you know how to apply it, it becomes wisdom, and that's self-preservation. So,
I can imagine that sort of step from, you know, competing at a university level. You want to do well and you're very passionate and stuff, but like say, I guess you want to do well for your coach and for yourself, but ultimately there's not the sort of pressure and the weight on it that when you've got all those other external individuals that are kind of putting that pressure and wanting you to achieve as well. And I feel almost as though, maybe I'm putting words into your mouth, but you almost lose the sense of what am I trying to achieve here, because you kind of start to want to do well for other people rather than wanting to do well for yourself, and almost the feeling that you used to get from running and from winning and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, that can get lost very quickly once these external pressures get bigger and the weight of responsibility as well. And that's why I want athletes to never lose your why you started. And I think in the beginning, because especially in the UK, we're not very professional, let's be honest. But we have that lovely club system, and it's you and your club. I was a very domestic athlete. I ran all over the country for my club. I just loved it because we had a lot of talent that would push each other. So we could get these fast times. on British soil. I know a lot of athletes like need to chase all these competitions, you know, in different cities in Europe and across the world, but it's expensive. And actually, I was so lucky that, you know, my coach would drive me for hours to Birmingham and, you know, even up to Scotland, and we'd do the National League. And what was happening is, on those journey, on those rides, he was building me up and he was nurturing me, and he got to know me, and he could tell how I was going to run just from how I stepped into the car that day. And you lose that a bit in the elite world, and it just becomes about the times, the weight. You know, are you looking like an elite athlete? What does an elite athlete look like? Let's have this discussion, shall we? Because I've looked, if you look on Google, I've had very different hairstyles. I've looked very different throughout my career, but I was still an elite athlete. And so, yeah, I just feel it's a very lonely world as well. And so you need to have that core group that are never going to let you lose touch of yourself and why you're there, because ultimately your identity is what's at stake. And as much as I wanted to be the best 800 meter runner in the world, and I got pretty close, I got to number 3. I mean, I was a bit biased, but you know, if you're looking to all these external things to determine your worth and whether you're a good athlete, oh, you're going to have a really tough time, you know, affirming yourself daily. So yeah, it's important to have that inner circle that grounds you to keep you, burst that bubble for you when it's needed.
And I think, you know, that inner circle where you know people have your back 100% and they're there to support you is so important, because I can imagine you touched on loneliness there, and it's interesting because, you know, you're going to have people that you run with that I'm sure became your friends, but equally they're your main competitors as well. So it's kind of, it's difficult because I'm sure that you've got that, you know, wanting to support each other, but also you want to win. And then there's that comparison that comes in, and kind of, you know, beating yourself up for not being the fastest, or, you know, comparing yourself to others.
Oh, yeah. The beating yourself up was a one I had to really get up grip with very early. I think it's interesting because I was always someone people were like, you're taking this very seriously. Why are you talking to everyone? I needed to feel joy at the competitions because if I was tense and I had a lot of trauma, I was blocking out, so I didn't want to bring that into my running space. And I would often meet that annoying athlete singing in the cool room. Part of it was my tactic, but I needed to be and joyful. And I love people, you know, I'm fascinated with people. When you grow up as a lonely child, you want to be around people. You know, I've done all these different sort of business chemistry and tests where they work out your personalities, and I'm what you call an integrator, and I love collaboration. I also love my own space, so I'm very confusing person, but anyway, it makes sense to me. And I was just
someone... I think I'm the same. Always say I'm an extrovert with a time limit. I get so much energy from other people, but when I need to go on my own, please leave me, like, don't speak to me.
So I was very comfortable talking to people that I was racing against, because once I stepped on the track, that was business time. As soon as I crossed the line, you know, I was able to, you know, recover once the lactic had left me. It was like, okay, like, and I watched a lovely rivalry. It was the Bucks University Championships just last weekend, and Joy Eze, and I forget the other young lady, they got a nice little rivalry, and they had a post-race interview, and they were saying, you know, how do you guys keep this going? You're friends and rivals. And they're like, just can't take it too seriously. Just don't take yourself too seriously. And it's so true. I used to look at some of the best athletes, and they would look at Usain Bolt. He was always joyful, just, you know, chilling on the line. and that's what worked, you know, like, be relaxed. And, you know, this is where the mindset comes in. Like, I knew there were certain cues I had when I stepped on the track. I would be like, okay, we're going from a massive stadium to the 8 lanes to my 1 lane. And let's do this. Like, I've worked hard for this. And my brain was able to just make those switches and be really agile. But once I crossed the line, win, lose or draw, life was going to go on. So it was time to keep it pushing. Let's go, you know, socialize and go and, you know, reassess things. I think everything has an appointed time. And definitely straight after the race, when you start to analyze your race, it's not a very good time. So it was like, where's the chocolate cake? Where's the dance floor? Let's go.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I used to, I mean, very different, but with exams, and people after the exam would want to talk about like, oh, what did you put for this answer and stuff. And I'm like, listening to this right now is not going to achieve anything other than stress me out. I can't even remember what I wrote for that question. So I'm definitely on the same thing as you. But one thing that I wanted to come on to with you is you mentioned it, Ricky, when you were thinking about, when you were talking about the different kind of pressures and things like that. And you said, am I the right weight? Do I look like an athlete? And that sort of thing. And I know that when I've listened to you speak before, you've spoken about your experiences of bulimia. And I wondered if you would be okay to share some insight into that and maybe how that played a role in your career.
Yeah, so this is definitely, you know, a really big conversation that I'm so honoured and privileged to now be a part of. Because for a long time, I don't know how to articulate it. You don't talk about it. So when I saw the Dump the Scales campaign that Hope started and she invited me, and I just started with holding up the picture back in 2020. And, you know, being at the march last week, it was like, wow, I feel seen and heard and like I belong and can support someone else through their journey if they resonate with anything that I'm going to say, because for a long time it's been unspoken and it's been my little secret and yeah, comfort in a crazy way. But yeah, so actually bulimia for me started at school because I was trying to fit in, always trying to fit in. And now I'm like, stand out where you can. You're only you're you and no one else can do you like you. And I wanted to be smaller. I wanted to be skinny. You know, I was from the era where we had thigh gaps and everyone wanted to be a model. I didn't actually want to be those things, but I wanted to fit in. And I didn't actually need to want to fit in because I already fitted in. I told you about that lovely boarding school I went to. And so, but, you know, it was an expression of something going on inwardly. And I knew I wasn't going to be, I don't know, this might, you know, I don't want to offend anyone. I didn't think I was going to be good at being anorexic because I love food so much. So let me eat loads of food and then get rid of it. So that's, you know, that was my pattern of behavior for a long time. And when I went to my second boarding school in Stoic, it was exacerbated because I was around really wealthy, white young girls who were my friends. Like, and I just wanted to be like my friends. And then I was running and building all this muscle. And hang on a minute, boys don't think I'm attractive. So it was just, you know, all this expectation. I had an amazing tutor and a really close friend who obviously noticed my change and what I was thought I was hiding. And although we didn't have, you know, the best support around it, but I think being in that environment was a way of kind of softly supporting me. And my tutor was just like, look, you want to go to the Olympics, right? You've got one body, look after yourself. And, you know, those words really stuck with me. And so I stopped purging probably like in sixth form. And I was like, let me just be the best athlete. Let me be healthy. Let me look after myself. And hey, I've got one body. And also I was trying to aesthetically change myself and I wasn't seeing the results because you don't. I look back at pictures of me now and it's like, oh, it's quite visible when I was unwell, but I never saw a change ever. I was always big. And so when I became an elite athlete, this was like years on, I think through uni, I kind of became quite healthy and was just, you know, had a good relationship with food through uni. And that's when my elite journey began. And one thing I'd always heard in athletics was, you're too big to be an 800 runner. You're too big to run the 800. You're never going to break 2 minutes. And so I told you I was fueled by no. So every time you tell me I can't do something, I'm going to show you why I can and do it really well. So I actually was doing, I was running 800 really well. I was running 400 really well. And I was breaking 2 minutes. So I was like, well, whatever. But then I became obsessed with, okay, I'm not going to show them with my running. I'm going to show them with how I look. And then again, a similar mindset to when I was at school, the girls I was running against were very different frame to me, predominantly white and just different somatotype. So I was thinking, okay, maybe that's what I need to aspire to and then I'll be accepted. So again, just this trying to fit in and be accepted instead of embracing what was making me stand out as an 800 meter runner. So it came to a head when we had an interesting head coach, and I've stopped naming his names in interviews, but it's very well documented on Google. He had a lot to say about my body. A lot of coaches, male coaches, had a lot to say about my body. Bearing in mind, you know, I went along with everything because we feel indebted. I would go and have all these testing, VO2 testing, and those results just weren't working for me. They would say, okay, well, according to this science, you should run this. And I was like, but I've already run 10 seconds quicker. So it doesn't correlate. And I feel like they were really trying to squash a diamond shape into a circle, and it just wasn't working. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at that point, my coach was very supportive. It was like my first pro coach AO. And he's like, look, Maz, let's just do it our way. And that's kind of where I got the maverick mindset that I have. And I look to people that I resonated with. So Serena Williams and Maria Mottola for the 800, if I make it more specific to me. She ran the 4, the 8, the 15. She did it all. And she was phenomenal at it all. And I kind of thought, that's more like what I'm like. I don't know how I'm running so fast, but there's something I'm doing right. And if they don't want to celebrate it, oh, well, I'm going to celebrate myself. And that's why I like work with Champion You, because you have to champion yourself. And but, you know, I was very obsessed with my aesthetic. Granted, genetics played a huge part in how lean I got. And certain times of the year, honestly, I didn't have to do anything. I was just going to be lean and run fast. But I always thought it was like, do, and don't eat here and eat this and do that, because, you know, the pressure of the governing body, like, you know, one time I was put on the skinny black dress diet, it was called. And I really just, you know, some of the language and some of the behaviors that we were kind of allowing in that culture, you know, I'm not running in a skinny black dress. So, I mean, granted, I'm in, you know, running half naked, but, you know, and basically it was a diet of not very much energy. And, you know, why I love the term dump the scales, because the scales meant nothing to me. I didn't look any different if I weighed 57 kg or 60 kg. It was about the power. It was about the training I put in. You know, you couldn't tell if I was 65 or 55 kg. I could, because I would feel it. Do I feel strong? Do I feel powerful? Even if it was just mentally, you know, if you're not fueling yourself, the mind, you know, and that's what I started to go off. I just never stepped on the scales again. And I just went off, how do I warm up today? How did I sleep last night? Have I got enough, you know, hydration in me? And I had to work really hard to protect my mind off that. I have to say, I did quite well when I was running well. When I was injured and when I wasn't running well, definitely the mind battle started again. And so it's this constant, you know, battle of, you know, come on, let's champion mindset. Like, are we doing everything well? Are we leaving no stones left unturned? The physical training side for me was pretty easy. My natural athletic ability and putting in the work, but was I fueling myself enough became the thing I had to really work on. And I did well until it crumbled in retirement. And then it all came flooding back because my body changed again.
That's something again I want to, but just before we go on to that, I want to ask more about sort of the skinny black dress diet thing. Mm. To me, I'm nowhere near an athlete. But I used to powerlift. I used to compete.
Some of your work in the gym, you are an athlete. It's amazing.
No, thank you. I am. I mean, I'm still in recovery from anorexia, but goddamn, like the strength that I now have is incredible, and I'm so much more like excited by that than whatever. It's the seeing, like you said, what my body can do rather than what my body looks like is incredible. But I think one thing that doesn't make logical sense for me. Why were coaches asking you to eat such an energy deficit? Because like that's not going to help your performance. And I would have thought that people, you know, as an athlete yourself, you might think I need to be smaller, to be more aerodynamic or to run faster or whatever. But for the coach to put that on you, it seems really weird to me, because they can surely comprehend that like you not eating enough means you're not going to have the energy to perform at your best.
I wish I had an answer for you. The culture when I was coming through was really archaic. And sadly, it's still going on today. So this is definitely a conversation I really want us to have in the sporting space and in performance generally. Mm-hmm. You know, how fast, I ran did not correlate with what I weighed on the scales at all. And yes, it was about fueling me, and everybody is unique, everybody is different and needs the right set of ingredients inside it to do well. And sometimes that ingredient for me was joy and peace and feeling supported, and wasn't always what I ate or drank that day. And so, yeah, there's a lot of education to be done, especially with our coaches, because there was just this whole thing of, you know, don't overeat, and there's certain foods you can and can't eat. Yes, if you're allergic to it and you know, and you've had the blood test to prove it, and you've had, you know, an adverse reaction or whatever. But, you know, people always say, oh my gosh, are you going to, it used to be very tricky, are you going to eat that? You're supposed to be an athlete. Watch me. Yeah, I'm going to eat that.
Cheese.
And yeah, there's a lot that went on. That's people just, awareness wasn't there. And because you have the role models, like don't get me wrong, if you train really hard, there is going to be a body type that, you know, is a result of that. That is healthy. And we still have it on the other end. There's people that are naturally very skinny and they eat really well. Ailish McCollum is a fantastic example of this, and I've been on trips with her, and she gets in like the most horrendous comments of people that just don't know. And so we need to be careful with how we judge, how we comment on people from the aesthetic. You know, I was always called big, and then people would meet me in real life and be like, oh, you're not actually that big. And I'm like, wow, was I like Michelin woman? And I think it triggered me, because in my head, that becomes when you hear something enough. So I want people to say, wow, you're fast, you raced well. And not necessarily, you know, just focused on what I looked like, because in the other, you know, when we move away from eating disorder awareness, you know, racially, you know, I would receive a lot of comments about how I looked. And there's a lot of discussions around colorism and, you know, all that stuff. And it's like, I'm just wanting to run for my nation. So, yeah, there's a lot of education that coaches need to go through, a lot of conversations. I think one thing that we need to stop in the sport, especially athletics and running community, is the complicit nature of, you know, when you know someone's struggling, obviously it's hard how you approach it, but not kind of encourage. I think eating disorders are glorified right now in the running culture. And that is
just saying culture.
Yeah.
Not just the running culture.
Yeah, it's really, really heartbreaking. And I think when I look back at, you know, the things that I thought were, I was doing well, they were really unhealthy and really toxic. But I was championed for doing it, glorified for doing it. So
yeah, and you know, that's, I would say, a thing in general society, and I'm sure it's amplified in when you're, you know, competing as an athlete as well. But if you think about the skills that you know, the characteristics and the traits that you need in order to be a good athlete, they do lend themselves to being fantastic at having an eating disorder. You know, I will always kind of, you know, semi-joke about the fact that I'm extremely dedicated, I'm perfectionistic, I'm ritualistic, you know, I'm very creative and things like that. And all of those are fantastic for me to thrive in my job or to thrive in the gym. My coach will always say, it is incredible how you can switch your mindset and you go to the darkest places and push yourself. Like, that is a quality to behold. And I'm like, yeah, you know, that's fantastic. And I'm so glad now that I've been able to find a sport that I absolutely adore. And now I can put my dedication and mindset into that rather than putting it into, I'm going to be the best at having an eating disorder. But for so long, that was my hobby, in a sense, was, you know, people were congratulating me because, oh God, I wish I could have your, wish I could resist cake like you can, or wish I could be as dedicated as you are in the gym and stuff. And I found that very tricky because I was like, this is actually destroying me and not allowing me to live my life. But you're congratulating me, which is so difficult. Like you say, when people don't know the full story, we really have to be careful.
Yes, and because, you know, I was needing affirmation, I grew up with very little affirmation, so the more people like complimented me, I was like, oh, well, better carry on, because I needed it, you know, at that time. So yeah, and a kudos to you for really, you know, reframing and turning that around, because I can't really compete or do sport at the moment because I still have to separate the obsessiveness with well-being. And mm-hmm. so that's okay. I've had many start stops, and I feel like going to the gym, I will. But a lot of the time I don't. It's more of definitely an energy thing. And then I'm starting to miss running, which is a good feeling, because for a long time it was like, but definitely I love spin class, and just when I'm around people, it's definitely something I want to do. But yeah, for now I'm just really enjoying like your Instagram posts. There's a lot of people doing it. Hyrox, I'm seeing a lot. That looks quite
yes. I haven't done Hyrox.
It looks tasty.
Yeah. I haven't done a Hyrox. I did a CrossFit competition like a month or so ago, and I've very much kind of gone from the powerlifting mindset of like, we are a community and we compete together, but it's just you on your own. And so like doing the competition was really amazing, but also a challenge for me, because I'd gone from very much competing on myself and just kind of mentally beating myself up about what I'd done, to then being in this group setting where you have to come together and you have to encourage people, and other people are encouraging you. And for me, that was brilliant, because it took that critic out of my head, and it was kind of, we did do really well in the end, but even if we didn't, we worked together as a team, and that was what was really encouraging. But I think it is hard when I can imagine as well, when it's been your career, to have that shift from running being your life and, there being the positives and the negatives, and then reaching that burnout, it's natural you're probably going to want to take some time away from it.
Yeah, I think as well, when you retire from something, I always say I'm very proud in people go, how old are you retired? I am retired. I'm in my second career. It's not the thing that you run back to straight away. I kind of thought when I would retire, I would just go and lay on a beach for I don't know how many months disappear, but life thing. So yeah, I think I'm just, and I worked with a phenomenal lady called Keisha Thomas, and she's a nutritional therapist.
I know Keisha.
Oh, she's amazing. And she really just helped me understand like how amazing my body is for starters, and how hard she'd worked for me, because I was not always kind and just been pushing. And actually I think when I finally stopped, it was just saying, this is my time now. And yeah, it was really, because you just want to control everything. I think I realized how much I was trying to control things, and often there's a lot you can't control, so you control what you control. My body was something I could control to the point I believe I could control my period. But when I stopped, I literally, I just, my body just did what she needed to do, and that was starting to heal. And I remember for about 6 months, I still looked like an athlete, and I was like, psh, did all that training for what? 6 months and one day, and I just ballooned. And at first I was like, quite proud of myself. I was getting softer and feeling more feminine. And then I just kept going, and then my clothes didn't fit, and then I started to panic. It's like, this is me now. Like, I'm fat. And I was like, but this is okay, and this is my new body. And just all these emotions just came through, and Keisha was like, stop right there and just look at what your body has achieved. Stop using these labels. Be kind. Fuel your body like you did when you were an athlete. Fuel your body. And yeah, so there was a lot going on when I first retired, and I just had to learn to love myself really and truly. So yeah, a lot of deep work has to happen.
I'm really interested there about your changing body, because I think, obviously that's something you experienced as retiring from being an athlete, but also that's something that a lot of people experience in recovery from an eating disorder. And I think, I don't know whether other people be the same, but for me, the hard part of recovery hasn't been kind of eating more and stuff. It's been the consequence of eating more and my body changing, because I tied so much of my identity to the way that I looked. Is that something you found in terms of your, your identity being the body that you had then built, and then all of a sudden it's no longer looks like that? And then for me, it was always the concern of, what's everyone thinking about me? Do they think I've let myself go?
Yes, the judgment, because I was judgmental. I spent a long time in America, working at the University of Central Florida as a assistant coach. And I remember going to these track meets and seeing these phenomenal American, like, former athletes. I was coached by a full-time Olympian, Johnny Gray. But what you'd see in the collegiate environment is a lot of these superstars coming back and coaching at the collegiate level. And I was like, wow, like, you won gold in 84 and you won, you know, 1992 and look at you now. And so, like, we would joke about it. We're like, we're not going to let ourselves go. We're going to run forever. That's unrealistic. you know, 2020, that was my onset of retirement. 2021, when I feel like I boomed. I was like, oh, this is what happens. And then I just assumed I let myself go. I wasn't really thinking about all the, you know, hormonal stuff that was happening. My eating was... Mm-hmm. I actually was drinking alcohol a lot more than I used to. I wasn't drink, like, I would just drink more than I would. Like, when I was at the outside, mm-hmm. no. And then you just do. So I struggled when my clothes didn't fit, because something about me is like, I love and I hate shopping. Like, I love buying new things, but I hate, like, in the changing room. Like, I just want to look at something and buy it. And I could do that for so many years. And then suddenly now, that doesn't fit me anymore, and I am not a size 8 or 10, 12 maybe. And so what? Like, I needed, and one thing Keisha was like, get a new wardrobe. Like, get stuff that, you know, don't fit into your clothes. Let your clothes fit you. And yeah, I just had to accept. But, you know, the really interesting thing that I realize is the body that kind of I have now, even though I was a young girl, it was kind of like, it was the body I had when I faced before sport, before bulimia. It was free. And obviously you're going to go through changes. Because one thing I know, when I was at school at Abbots Hill, that was one of my happiest seasons of life. Like, we have our quarterlies, me and my six friends, and we meet in London. And we just go, didn't we just love school? Yeah, we just love school. And I was free. I just loved me. And I think that's what I've got back to now. There was no conditions, no judgment. You know, I want to just be balanced and at peace. And, you know, talk about things like, you know, periods and stuff. It's, you know, I used to, that's why I say I could control it, because I didn't, like, the changes that I have now when it's that time of the month, I never saw that in sport, because I didn't give it space to happen. Like, if I've got a race, definitely I'm not having a period. Do you know what I mean? Like, no, we can't. Whereas now it's like, oh, this is what my friends were saying when they had cramps and I didn't have that, quite that compassion. Like, I need to, like, not lift as heavy in the gym anymore. And so, yeah, I'm just free and in tune, I would say, with my body, rather than just suppressing and controlling. And it's a relationship. I had to, and a relationship is getting to know one another and working together. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's so inspiring to hear, because I think, for me, and listeners may kind of appreciate this as well, is I, at the depth of anorexia, I very much felt like there was my body and there was my mind and there was no connection between them. But to hear that you have found a space where you can listen to your body and you can adapt the way that you're maybe living your life, and, you know, like you say, lifting heavier weights or something. I'm very similar in that whatever's going on, no, you're going and you're doing it because that's what's programmed. But to have that compassion and that acceptance that some days might be different. And my coach will often say that to me. She's like, your program's there, but on the day, like, you know, how are you feeling today? Because we might need to check in. And because she's so open and willing to do that, I'm like, okay, that's fine. That's what she says is best. So that's what we can do. But it's really nice to hear that that's a place that you've reached, and you can, you know, listen to your body and what you need and, you know, whatever it needs, you want to care for it.
100%. And I think because of athletics and sport, you are hypersensitive to your body. I think I just didn't listen. I didn't pay attention. And I just decided to override. You know, kind of when you just override that, yeah, this is what's happening today, and that's not kindness and that's not love. And I moved into that space where, you know, my worth and my identity is not just being an athlete, and there's other things I want to achieve with my life. I want to, you know, find my life partner. I want to have a family. I want to be a good sister, friend. And, you know, who I was often when I was kind of just suppressing myself, not being kind to myself, that spills over into other relationships. And so, yeah, I just You know, I wanted to make sure that I was, if you don't know how to love yourself, the person you spend the most time with, you probably won't love others that well, you know?
Yeah. Which I always think is so interesting, because in culture nowadays, we are living in grind culture. You know, if you can keep pushing yourself, like just keep going, no matter what happens, no matter what's going on in life, push, push, push to get to whatever. I mean, I think in most cases, there's not really a clearly defined goal in mind. It's just keep going no matter what, sometimes without even achieving things. But actually, when you take a step back and you think, okay, so I'm going to use the example of anorexia again here, but this is something I've come to realise recently, is that I just kept pushing and pushing to be smaller and smaller and eat less and, you know, do more. No sort of regard of what impact that was going to have, but I knew that the one thing I wanted to achieve was to just kind of get sicker with the anorexia. And actually, what impact that had was that work started to fall apart. My relationship started to fall apart. My friends kind of, you know, they really tried, but I was no longer a person that they actually wanted to be around. My family were worrying, and it meant that the person that I was no longer the best version of myself. And whereas actually now that I'm being more kind to myself and have compassion for myself, people actually want to be around you, and you're a person that they want to have. Whereas when you're that kind of driven go-getter,
yeah,
it's not that appealing to have you around as a person if it's in a negative sense. And so I've really recently been trying to say to myself, be somebody that you'd want to be friends with. And the girl that I was a few months ago was not somebody that I'd want to be friends with. The person I am now, yeah, I might consider her as a friend.
Ah, I consider you a friend. Hang out.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's so, so true. And just that kind of, I want to say like focus, but not always channeled the best way. But no, it's powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. It has been such a pleasure to finally record this with you. It's been so lovely to learn more about you and your story. So thank you so much. Where can people go to keep in touch with you and the work that you're doing?
Amazing. So I know you're very good at social media, so don't judge me. But basically, you can find me on Instagram. I will annoy your timelines. I'm Marilyn Okoro, Oly, O-L-Y. So my letters from the Olympics. But I am, that's across socials, so also Twitter and LinkedIn. I love a LinkedIn connection. So, yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. And I hope you have a nice rest of your day.
Thank you for having me. You too. Bye.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.